quite often you have gun violence or prevention organizations that use survivors, and they use their stories for their own fundraising.
Welcome, and this is Far Betterment. Hi, welcome to Far Betterment. This intro is going to be a little bit different. I recorded this episode last week on the night of July 30th with a person that I admire and care for greatly. She's one of the best humans I know. And like many other Americans before and after, she suffered a great loss at the cost of domestic terrorism, gun violence, mass murder. On July 20th, 2012, an animal went into a theater and slaughtered 12 people and wounded countless others. One of those was her daughter and our friend, my wife and I, Jessie Gowie, who some of you know as Jessica Redfield. Now, first off, I want to say how absolutely disgusted I am as a human that this reality of having to look for exits and hiding places and plan escape routes has become commonplace. Words and thoughts and prayers couldn't ever be enough to make up for the senseless and inexcusable loss of life that we've suffered. And I want to be clear, we did suffer. We do suffer. All of us suffer these losses. And I hope none of us forget what a great loss and tragedy this all is. every time, which is a horrible statement in and of itself, every single time. This is an all-encompassing human and specifically American problem. Let's not forget those humans had families and friends and were mothers, fathers, sons, daughters, cousins, uncles, aunts, and grandparents. They were the most important person in someone's life. They were loved. They were necessary. They were needed. And they'll be missed forever. And unless we've been directly impacted, and I hope that none of you ever have to experience that on a personal level, we can't imagine the impact those losses will have and how many countless lives are affected. The collateral damage alone is immeasurable. Now, Jessie, she changed every room that she walked into, and she gave life to you when you needed it most. And I am so grateful and thankful that I got to know her for the very short time that I did. I was very, very lucky. We didn't get to know her as well as most, but enough to appreciate the friendship that she gave us. I want to thank Sandy for being on and speaking with me. And it's unfortunate that this comes at a time in our lives where these conversations are so fresh, and I absolutely hate the coincidence of it. But I think this is an important conversation to have right now. Sandy and her equally amazing husband have written a book, along with author Tom Diaz, about these very conversations and why, as a culture, we aren't making the necessary changes to fix this. The book is called Tragedy in Aurora, The Culture of Mass Shootings in America, and it comes out August 14th. So please be on the lookout for that and make sure you go pick that up. Also, Lonnie and Sandy were on an episode of 60 Minutes discussing gun violence in America and gun culture, along with many other important subjects. I'll link that in the description for this episode. Please make sure to go check that out. And if you'd like to help provide assistance and counseling to victims of gun violence and also, you know, help fight the necessary fight, you can visit survivorsempowered.org and donate to them and share their cause and mission as far and as wide as possible. Again, that's survivorsempowered.org. So without further ado, and thank you so very much, here is Sandy Phillips for Far Betterment. Hey, Sandy, how are you doing?
I'm doing all right. How are you doing?
Good. Sorry, it's so late.
I didn't even realize it was as late as it is because I've been watching the debates and throwing things at the television.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I can understand. I can't even watch that stuff anymore. The last four years of...
I can watch the debates, the Democratic debates, but I can't watch anything with Trump on. I just can't anymore.
Well, and you have a really... unique perspective. You know, you're living in Texas and, you know, swing really liberally. So.
Not very, no.
No, okay. That's my fault then.
No. I'm definitely a lot more liberal than I've ever been in my life. But I'll tell you, living here in Texas and seeing some of the bumper stickers and some of the flags, and I'm sure you get that in North Carolina too.
Absolutely, yeah. It's funny. We have people visit and they see like the battle flag and they're like, oh my God, what? I can't believe that people have those. And it doesn't even occur to me anymore because they're everywhere.
Everywhere, yeah. Exactly. So, you know where I saw a ton of them and was really surprised was in Delaware.
Oh, really? Yeah, that is surprising.
Yes. I mean, it was like, what the hell? This was not the South.
That's really interesting, actually.
Isn't it?
Yeah,
I wouldn't
think that those would be there.
I said to Lonnie when we were driving through, I think they might be a bit confused on geography.
Maybe. Yeah, you see those everywhere out here, though, at people's houses and...
I know, it's strange.
On cars.
There's an underbelly of our society that I just didn't realize was there, you know?
It's been an interesting 4 years, to say the least.
It sure has.
You know, without getting too political, it's been really incredible and not in a good way to see all the things that have been kind of lurking in the underbelly.
Under the rocks. Mm-hmm. But they're not under the rocks anymore.
Absolutely. It's a shame. It's a shame.
It is. And hopefully we'll get it back. Hopefully it's not too late. But boy. Like I said to a friend not long ago, I am going to vote blue no matter who, and I might have to hold my nose to do it, but it's got to be better than the alternative.
I totally understand that line of thinking.
Yes. Yeah. So tell me about your podcast. Tell me about North Carolina. Tell me about how you're enjoying it or if you're enjoying it.
Well, North Carolina has actually been pretty good. You know, I was really kind of concerned when we first moved out here about, you know, moving to the South. And we're not that far south, really.
Right.
But it's still, you know, in the South. And didn't know what that was going to be like and if there's going to be any culture shock. And there was a little bit at first. But for the most part, the people are really nice. And there's definitely like a lot of traditional values out here. It's not, you know, so progressive like Colorado.
Right.
But people are generally tolerant and good. But, you know, I found that that's kind of how it is everywhere. You know, I go into a place hoping for the best, and a lot of times I'm not disappointed. But... it's been good. It did take some getting used to just because things are a lot slower out here. And things are different and there are some very strong opinions. And, you know, although people are tolerant, they still have their strong opinions and I've got mine, and that, you know, can cause some tension sometimes. But I had to get out of Colorado.
Yeah, I think that's true. You know, I think that's true in everywhere we go these days. There's just so much divisiveness
Yes.
And no, and now when you have, I'm sorry, but when you have a president that's encouraging that, and it's whoa, I can't believe some of the things that I'm hearing these days that are just, 5 years ago, nobody would have said.
Yeah. It really feels like we've taken it like 10 steps backwards. It's sad.
Yeah. And what worries me is, the pendulum always swings. So it'll go way far over here where we think, I hope it doesn't go any further than it currently is. But then I'm afraid it'll go back the other way and be too far the other way. So, to find our center again as a nation, I think is going to be difficult.
I think we were close, We were close at a point, especially towards the second, half of Obama's presidency. I thought we were pretty close to the middle.
I did too.
And it just seems like it's all been undone pretty quickly.
Doesn't it?
But
because it has been.
It was a smart strategy, though. That's the thing that's unfortunate, is how smart that strategy was and how well it worked.
Yeah. Yes. And how sad.
Yeah.
Well, we quit teaching. I said this to the kids when they were still in school. They quit teaching critical thinking in school. And my kids, well, I was fortunate enough that most of their early education was in private schools. So they learned that skill, and they would challenge, and they would go, well, what's the other side of this? And my son is still the master debater. He will debate anything just for the sake of debating it. But it shows me that he can at least really look at both sides of a subject and then find his right way to negotiate through that and to come up with his own conclusions. And it's a shame that so many Americans just take the sound bites and don't get involved, which is why we're where we're at.
Yeah.
Well,
and I'm definitely guilty of that. I mean, I don't follow any news sources anymore because I'm just, it's all awful.
It's all awful.
No matter which way you look at it, no matter what side you listen to, it's just all terrible. And so
terrible, but it's all we've got, and we've got to take care of it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and that's the thing, is I have such a positive outlook on life in general. I think just being a parent, I want my kids to see that things are good and most people are good, and even though good people do bad things, it doesn't make them completely bad people. I want my kids to see that. And so I guess I really try to avoid that whole doom and gloom kind of like storyline that the media has been putting out over the last few years. It makes things seem so hopeless, I guess.
And I think that's part
sad.
Of the, when you have... when you have leadership that has a different moral compass and different agenda than really being a servant to their country, I think that happens. And when we allowed big money into politics, we really screwed ourselves over. And I think that's why we have what we have. And hopefully it will right itself. I still believe it can be, and I'll do everything I can to get us back to where we once were and further ahead with understanding and compassion for one another, because that's what's being taken away.
Well, I think you have. I think you're really out there on the front lines, It all started in Jessica's name, Jessie's name, I guess, as we all know her. But it really started with in her name, and now you've really taken it to a whole nother level, and you and Lonnie are out there traveling the country and speaking, and you guys have a book coming out. You said August 14th, right?
Yep, August 14th.
Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Are we recording now or?
Yes. Oh, sorry. It starts like it's a Skype thing and it starts as soon as I call.
Sorry. Well, then you're putting lots of good information and that's all right. No, I don't mind at all.
I can cut out whatever you want.
No, I don't mind at all. I'm so sorry. I always feel like whatever I say to whoever I say it is perfectly okay because I would say it to anyone's face or in any interview. I'm very, as you already know, I'm very open with my opinions and, you know, with what we've gone through and what we currently do and you know, how we live our lives. You can't hide much, you know?
Yeah, that's true. No, I love that about you, though. You know,
thank you.
One of the things I admire the most about you. You tell it like it is. You don't have the luxury to sugarcoat anything, and you shouldn't. And I absolutely appreciate that.
I used to tease Jesse about not having a filter, and now I don't have one.
She was good about that, though. she was great. I loved. I loved talking to her and just like our text messages and stuff. Like she was just so, I don't know. She just made the day, I guess, nicer to put it simply.
Yeah. She was a great, you know, I used to sing "You Are My Sunshine" when she was little, but she really was, and she was such a bright spot, you know, and a bright light, and you know, that the whole little bit of sass, a little bit of crass, a little bit of class, you know, that whole thing that she really kind of it was her brand without being a brand, without intending it to be, but that's really who she was, and you couldn't help but get caught up in her enthusiasm and her joie de vivre. She enjoyed life and every aspect of it, and even when things went bad, she would find something to find funny or, this is what I've learned from that kind of thing. And she was a joy.
That's so perfectly defines, you know, even just in the short time we knew her. She came, I don't know if you knew this, but she came to us in a time where we were really struggling with wanting to stay in Colorado. And, you know, we had a first child. And so you start losing friends and things through that. And so we were really, you know, debating, do we want to stay here or not? And then, you know, we met her and Jay and we got along so well. And we thought, you know, she was just a client and that was it. And then she kept talking to us and we thought like, oh, you know, maybe it's not, you know, maybe we can still make friends. Maybe people do still want to talk to us, you know, even though we have this new baby. And so we kept talking to her and things were going great. You know, we thought we had this new friend and we're going to stay and see how things went with, you know, everybody else and our family and trying to start over. And it was just kind of perfect timing. And then, you know, everything happened and that was it for us. We were, that sealed it for us. We had to go. And I don't know if you knew that was part of our decision, but.
I didn't.
But it for sure.
But I can certainly understand it because I look at all the people that were in Denver when Jesse was there and part of the reason why she went there, and most of them are gone. In fact, over the 20th, which is the Tragiversary date, posted on Facebook and said, you know, these are the people that, you know, were in Jesse's life. And they're all gone now. They're living other places, or they've married and have children, or big careers, or whatever. And we don't hear from many of them at all anymore. And that always makes me sad, because I'm still stuck in 2012.
Yeah.
You know.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
in many ways. And, you know, it would be so nice to still have them around. So whenever one of her friends calls, or we get together for drinks or have dinner or, you know, a meal together, it's always so very special, because it brings her back to life just for a few moments.
That was, I mean, I can't even imagine, you know, what that was like for you guys, especially just, I mean, over the last few years, you know, it's not like you can really forget about it, but I think you guys have really honored her and honored her name and really like done so much good for her and put out so much good in the world that it doesn't negate the bad that happened, obviously, but it really...
No, it never will. And you never get over that kind of trauma. And that's what that's kind of the message that we're taking to other survivors, is that you don't get over this, and don't let anyone tell you you should, because you can't. And they just don't understand your trauma. And encouraging them to live their best lives, whatever that means for them, and to be sure that they have the resources to do that and the services that they know what services are out there. And we concentrate a lot on trauma therapy, because we have seen that those who do get trauma therapy early do much better, and they're able to move forward, not move on. It's very different. You don't move on, you move forward. And you move forward in a way that is much healthier for you and for others around you. So that when you are triggered by your trauma, whether it's PTSD or depression or whatever, that you're aware of it, and you can use the skill sets that are taught, and use those so you don't react in a negative way to others or to yourself. But we had a small class in Denver not long ago, and at the end of the class, I was noticing that people were responding to the training in such a way that it was much more emotional than I had expected. So at the end, I started asking, well, have you had trauma therapy before? Well, no. And how long has it been since this happened to you? Well, 16 years, 24 years, 1 year. There were some Parkland students there that had never received any trauma therapy. They had received talk therapy, they had received counseling, but they had not received trauma therapy. So now we're putting some programs together that include trauma therapy and wellness concepts like meditation and deep breathing techniques and tapping, EMDR, grounding, all of that. So we'll have programs for survivors of gun violence to be able to attend and learn the skill sets, and then decide which one that they might want to try, and be able to find those people when they get back home to continue that process. Eventually, we'd like to be able to have these classes all over the country and have them be free to the survivors that want to participate. That's our goal. It's a big goal.
It is, but I think with your determination, I think... You know, I don't see anything that you can't accomplish, honestly. I mean, you guys have come so far in the last, you know, 7 years or so. It's really incredible. And I don't mean to like toot your horn too much, but I think it's well deserved. I mean, Survivors Empowered has grown like enormously. And I think you guys have really changed the way that people deal with tragedies. Of course, you know, having the classes and everything are huge. How have you seen things change since you started?
Oof. There are just so many more mass shootings. You know, they're happening at a much more rapid pace. Mm-hmm. And we're I think as a country, we're still trying to bury our heads in the sand and say, oh, this isn't happening, this isn't happening. But fact of the matter is we have many mass shootings every day that never make the news. And they're usually domestic violence where someone kills their family and their spouse and then takes their own life by suicide. And that's happening everywhere, every day. But it doesn't get reported anymore because it's not shocking. The big ones are the ones that get reported and where 12 people are killed and 70 wounded, and the school shootings get coverage because they're so shocking that we're killing our children in America. You know, so there was a shooting this last weekend mm-hmm. where 12 people were shot. They weren't killed, but they were shot, and it didn't really get any news at all.
Yeah.
And then I think of all the families that we've met across the country who have lost at least two, and sometimes the one I know the most number of children have been lost by one family. Four children to a woman that she lost all four of them, but at different years to gun violence. And that's when you kind of grab your chest and go, oh, my God, and you're still standing. As devastating as it is just to lose one, to lose four in different years, in different ways, and none of them their fault. None of them were doing anything they shouldn't have been doing. And that's when you go, that never even made the news. Nobody knows about that woman who has lost four children. Another woman that we know lost her daughter in a shooting, domestic violence. And 20 years later, she was pregnant with her son at the time that it happened. And 20 years later, her son is shot and killed in a robbery. And you just kind of shake your head and go, you know, these are the stories that most Americans never hear about or know about. So they don't realize that it's happening everywhere to anyone at any time. And that's what we're trying to make people aware of. And hopefully that they will get involved to some degree to want to change it. And we are very political, but Survivors Empowered is not. Survivors Empowered is simply to help support survivors of gun violence, no matter what their politics are, no matter how they feel about guns, whether they hate them, love them, own them, doesn't matter to us. And we've been lucky enough that our work has gotten the attention of Anderson Cooper from 60 Minutes, and he did a very, very nice segment on us earlier in the year, and we were very surprised and shocked and very happy that he did that, because all of a sudden, you know, all of a sudden people knew who we were, because we're just two people. That's all we are. We're just two people, we put every penny that we have into doing what we do. And I am very proud of what we are doing and the people that we're helping.
You should be. And I think we're all very proud of you as well. I know my wife and I are very proud to even, you know you.
I mean, thank you.
No, really. I mean, you have, whether you know it or not, you've helped myself quite a bit, as you know, with your kindness and always being like so receptive to having conversations with me. And you know, I went through a lot of guilt and a lot of, I don't know, shame and all kinds of stuff. Over the last few years, you know, because of this. And you always were so kind every time. And so I always appreciated that.
Well, thank you. That's a very kind thing to say and very unnecessary. We're here for the people that need us to be there. And it doesn't matter, you know, if you're a victim survivor or not. You know, if you were a friend of Jesse's, you're a friend of ours. So that simple.
That's really nice of you to say. I appreciate that. It is.
No, it's true.
Well, so let's hop into the book. Let's talk about that. August 14th. I want everyone to remember August 14th. Don't forget it. let us know, you know, a little bit about it, how it came about. And,
the book is called Tragedy in Aurora, The Culture of Mass Shootings in America. And we had started reading books early on after Jesse was slaughtered and wanting to know more about the gun issue and the culture of guns and why we were finding ourselves in the situation that we're in America. First of all, awash with guns. First of all, we've got almost 400 million guns in our country, which is more people. We have more guns than people. And, you know, how did that happen? And then how did our laws get written and then weakened? And, you know, we just started researching. And one of the authors that we kept coming across was a man by the name of Tom Diaz. And a couple of years later, we got to meet him at a conference we were attending, and we were very impressed with him, and we told him how much we loved his books and how we actually used them as research. So whenever we wrote something or spoke on something, we would look up, you know, well, what did Tom have to say? And he was very honored by that. But it was the truth, and we still use his books to as research, but now we can call him. And
that's a great resource to have.
Yeah, it really is. And he got to be a friend, and we started talking about a book that we were thinking of writing with another author. And she had actually pitched it several times, and it was a very different book than the book that we actually ended up writing with Tom. It was more about Jesse's story and who Jesse was, and it wasn't getting the interest. So she said, I want this book to be written, but evidently, I'm not going to be the person to write it. So she stepped aside, and that's when Tom stepped in. He goes, this is what I want to do with the book. And we were like, yes, because we were hesitant before, as wonderful a writer as she is, and she is a dynamite writer, but as wonderful as she is, it was too much about Jesse and us. And that story's been told by almost every parent who has lost a child to gun violence, and rightfully so. We want to honor our children, but we wanted to take it further than that and combine what happened to Jesse to what has happened with our culture and gun violence. So Tom wanted to make that same story happen, and we started working with him, and we had fortunately had a wonderful book agent that was enthusiastic, and that's how it happened. So it is our story, but it's a story attached to why we are in the situation that we're in and what we can do to change it. And part of that is we have gun violence prevention organizations that are run from Washington and New York, but they may even say that they're grassroots organizations, but you can't be a grassroots organization if it's top-down management. Grassroots has to be grassroots up. And we want that to happen in our country. And we want it to be led by survivors and we want the survivors to be the ones in charge, and to be able to tell their stories authentically without somebody telling them, oh, you can't say this, or we don't agree with that, to cut this. We don't want that. We want the survivor stories to be real and to be their story and not edited by somebody in New York or Washington, D.C.
Have you guys found that happen a lot of pushback? I mean, because we wouldn't see that on this end, you know, just as viewers.
Yes. Well, what we have found in the 7 years that this has been our life mm-hmm. is quite often you have gun violence or prevention organizations that use survivors, and they use their stories for their own fundraising and for their own agenda. And survivors will go along with that because they desperately want their stories to be told. But the fact of the matter is, once you're not the new shiny object, and once your story has kind of been told and they've been able to use that story to gain traction on their agenda, then they move on to the next and the next and the next. And we see a lot of survivors who have been hurt by these organizations, including us. We had gone to work for the Brady organization after Jesse was killed, and we were so excited We were so excited to be telling Jesse's story and to get people involved in the issue that we didn't realize what was really going on. And they got us involved in the lawsuit to take on the PLACA. Now, PLACA stands for the Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act. And it says you cannot sue anyone in the gun industry. So they talked us into a lawsuit to take on Lucky Gunner, who sold our killer over 6,000 rounds of ammunition over the internet without even needing an ID or checking to see if the ID matched the address and the credit card that he was using. I mean, nothing. You just order it and you send it, and they receive it, and off you go. So we were like, well, if he was able to do that, how many other people with ill intent, including terrorists, are able to be doing the same thing? And that should be, that's an outrage, and that needs to be changed. Well, we went to court, and it was thrown out on its first first hearing. It was thrown out because of the PLACA lawsuit, because of the PLACA law, excuse me. And we were assessed a $264,000 fee to the attorneys on the opposite side. And the judge knew that it was really a Brady lawsuit, not our personal lawsuit, and he reduced it to $203,000 and suggested that Brady pay that. Of course, they didn't. And even though they had promised to have our backs, they didn't. And they literally forced us into bankruptcy. So we had to declare bankruptcy. We have a little trailer that we travel around the country in, and we work with survivors to make sure that those kinds of things don't happen to them, and encourage them once again to stand up for themselves, use their voices, and make sure that they're getting the support and the help that they need emotionally.
That is, I actually remember seeing a news article about that back when it was going on. That's absolutely insane.
Yeah, it was, you know, when we're older, you know, we're old, we're elderly. And when you lose everything, along with losing your precious daughter, it can take you to your knees. But instead, I think we both just got so angry that it happened that we just rose up and decided we'd fight. And I don't know if that's so smart or not, but that's what we're doing. And we're encouraging others to fight for themselves as well and to stand up for themselves and honor their loved ones the way they want to be honoring their loved ones, and not the way somebody else tells them they should.
That's really incredible. And I guess I've always wanted to ask you this, but I guess I haven't had the opportunity, but how do you do it? Like, how do you keep going? How do you, you know, keep fighting every day, and how do you push forward?
Well, I take lots of little breaks. You know, we might have several days that there are, you know, there's a big push and we're working long hours and we're talking to a lot of survivors, or there's been a mass shooting and we have to raise enough funds to go and be there for those who might need our support. And then there's other times that cycle can burn out. I just got to take a day away, or, you know, do something totally different. And we've learned the signs of, okay, I'm hitting the wall. And we also try to teach that to other survivors too, is to, you know, be very aware of, I call it soul care, not self-care. Because self-care sounds like, okay, it's time for me to go get a pedicure or a manicure, where soul care is listening to yourself and getting inside your own head and your own heart to know, okay, I'm really hurting right now, or I'm feeling anger, or I'm feeling frustrated, or I'm feeling overwhelmed, whatever emotion that you're feeling, and to be able to step back from that and say, okay, I've now identified what I'm feeling. What am I going to do about it? What skill sets do I have? Do I need to just sit down and read a book for a little while? Do I need to do some deep breathing? Do I need to shut everything down for a day or two? And we've learned to do that and identify it in each other. Of course, July is by far the worst month for us. And trauma is held on a cellular level. So your body knows when the trauma is coming. And I know July is going to be my worst month because that's the month that we lost her. And my body actually knows almost what day it is without looking at the calendar or even thinking about it. I can just feel it coming on. And I can also now feel it when it's waning, when it's like, okay, the worst is over now. I'm going to be able to recover now. So we have found ways of dealing with that. And it's sometimes successful and sometimes not as successful as we would like it to be. But we're still learning. And still teaching.
I am just always in awe of you guys. And especially during, you know, well, obviously you said July is a really, really hard month, but, you know, and you brought this up, but the garlic festival that just happened.
Yes.
What is... I know, you know, usually I see you either speaking on TV or speaking on Facebook or, you know, talking about it. But what does that look like, you know, first of all, for Survivors Empowered, but for yourself? You know, are you reaching out to survivors right away, or are people contacting you guys?
You know, it's a little of all of the above. There are times that... we know immediately that, okay, whatever it takes, we have to get there, like Parkland. We knew no matter what, we had to get to Parkland, and we did. And we were able to meet with a family whose son was killed and have since become very good friends, and they credit us with their getting trauma therapy very, very early. And they're both doing exceptionally well with their grief and moving forward with their lives. And that's why, you know, I'm able to say that we know that those who do get trauma therapy early on do so much better. So, Parkland was an example of you just pick up and go and you meet as many people as you can and you dig in as deep into the community as you're able to. And that was a very successful trip on many, many levels. And at the same time, a devastating trip because you know what those people are going through and what they're feeling and what their nightmare is. And of course, in a community, when communities are affected, and especially this happens with school shooting, because it is a community that's affected. In our situation, out of the 12 people that were killed, a lot of them were not from Colorado. And so it wasn't the same kind of response or community that school shootings have. And what happens after a while is you start to see people kind of fray, that they don't stay together because they have different agendas, they have different emotions, they have different political beliefs, they have different religious beliefs. So you see them come very close together at first, and then they kind of fray, for lack of a better word. They come shred, and sometimes it's done politely, and other times not so much. So you see that in these communities, and it's another layer of grief. It's another layer of trauma. You see friendships fall apart, and that was hard to tell. That's always hard to tell people because they think that, oh, the people that are here with me now or have been my friends for 20, 30 years, they'll always be here for me, and they're not. They can't handle your grief, and so they fade away. But what happens is you start to meet other people that are survivors of gun violence, and they become your family, your extended family. And that's the best blessing that comes from all of this trauma, is that you do meet people that understand, and you don't have to explain why you're in the middle of a sentence and start crying, or when a song comes on the radio and all of a sudden you're losing your train of thought and you can't pay attention because you're listening to the song that was your daughter's favorite song. You don't have to explain any of that because they know, and they get it, and they understand. So they become your extended family.
It sounds like that's really what Survivors Empowered is about, is building a family. And
yes, it is. It is. That if you wanted to say, what is it really all about? It's about creating a supportive family.
I'm going to get a little bit political here, and I don't think you'll be afraid to answer this question.
No, I'm never afraid of any of it.
But I know that, you know, in the beginning, you guys had met with President Obama, and he spoke with you guys, and, you know, you guys had some contact with him there. Do you see a major difference between him and Trump? I have a hard time saying President
Trump. That's like saying, is there a difference between night and day?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Although I will tell you, it took a while for Obama to get it.
Okay.
When Jesse was killed, it was right before the presidential debates mm-hmm. of 2012, and he and Romney would not even discuss the gun issue. They'd been told, oh my gosh, it's a third rail issue. Don't talk about it. And everybody was afraid of it. And then 5 months after Jesse was killed, we had Sandy Hook. And that changed everything for the president. And he, I think because it was so many children and he had knowledge of what those bullets do to the human body. And he had already gone through, I think at that point he had already gone through four or five other mass shootings since ours, where he was meeting with families and talking with families. And so, you know, it was becoming too often. And I think he was having a moral dilemma of, how can I not talk about this? How can we not look at this? And when Sandy Hook happened, that was it. And it really took him to his knees. And we got to meet him shortly thereafter. And we were lucky enough to meet with him a couple of times. And as well as some other people in his cabinet. And to see that whole attitude change, and the awareness change, and the education level change, because part of our jobs as survivors is to educate politicians who may think they know everything and don't, and the media as well. And we're, for the first time, seeing the media correct politicians or speak out about politicians and their gun stance. So that's been rather, in fact, today on as they were getting ready for the debates, one of the pundits, if you will, was saying, you know, Bernie has a D-minus rating with the NRA, but when you look at how he's voted on gun bills, he's not very good on guns. And we're like, yes, we finally taught them that. You know? But it's been an interesting path to find out that these politicians will come at you with these facts and figures that are not facts and figures. They're just NRA talking points. So the difference between the current White House resident and Obama is really like comparing night to day, because, well, first of all, I don't know if you know this or not, but Trump received $30 million from the NRA. So even when he said, well, you know, we're going to do something after Parkland, we're going to do something about that, the next day he met with the NRA and backpedaled the whole way and has done nothing. So, yeah, so that's what we get.
It's unfortunate, but...
Yeah, because people are dying.
Yeah.
You know, it's not something this country can afford to wait on anymore. There are solutions, and we can do this as a nation, and we must do it as a nation. It is not okay to have 100 people in America killed every day by guns. That's not okay.
What do you think that solution is?
Oh, I think it's multi-leveled, and there are a lot of things that need to be done. But, you know, first and foremost, we're in favor of a ban on assault weapons and their accessories. And by ban, I mean those that are already in existence, you grandfather, like we did with the machine guns. Mm-hmm. So you grandfather them. You can keep them if you want, but you're going to pay to keep them, and you're going to register them so we know where they are. But there is absolutely no reason for any civilian in this country to own a weapon of war, and that's what they were designed to be. And we need to get a grasp on that, and we need to start asking ourselves, you know, why do we have bullets that are armor piercing, and why do we have bullets that were meant for war in the hands of any civilian who wants them? And we need to stop that. We need to get that stopped. So there are a lot of bills that are being proposed state to state to state that are passing. And we're hoping that if we take back the White House and if we can turn the Senate where we can actually get laws passed or even introduced, then we can get something done.
Do you think that people are tired of it yet? That I guess that's the problem I've always had, is that it seems like, you know, another awful mass shooting happens, and then, you know, people are up in arms about it for, you know, some time, and then they move on. And it just seems like people aren't sick enough.
Well, they don't think it can happen to them, number one. Mm-hmm. I mean, we never thought anything like this. We taught Jesse, you hang out with good people. You don't put yourself in dangerous situations. But the problem is, every place is a dangerous situation now.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't matter if it's a concert, a church, a theater, a school, a festival. It doesn't matter. You're walking down the street. It doesn't matter. You can be anywhere and end up a victim or a witness to something that nobody should see on an American street. And this country is at war with itself and doesn't realize it. So, yeah, I think there is a problem. When you choose to stay ignorant about a subject that is as crucial as life and death, and you choose to stay ignorant about it, not stupid, ignorant, and not get the facts and the knowledge that you need to talk to this issue and do something about it that's constructive, instead of destructive, then you're part of the problem.
That's such a poignant point that you bring up about every place being dangerous, especially for us. Like, it really hits home. You know, after the Aurora Theater shooting, we were the same kind of people. We never thought that could happen to us. And, you know, I had lived in Colorado through Columbine and those things. And you just never think it could happen to you. And that's such a great point. I mean, now I'm looking at exits everywhere we go. You know, it took me years before I could go back to a movie theater or a restaurant, a crowded place. It really took years.
I still can't go to the movies.
Yeah.
I can go in a theater to speak, but I can't go in to see a movie. When we go to a restaurant, I always sit facing the door.
Yeah.
You know, it changes your life. And then I have to ask, and I do ask other people, is that freedom?
Yeah.
When you're constantly looking over your shoulder or thinking, when I take my kid to school today, is he or she going to come home? And I have so many mothers especially who say, I think that every day.
We certainly
and
do.
Is that freedom? That is not freedom.
We certainly think about that. I mean, we started homeschooling our children because of that. And I absolutely think about that every single day. Especially after Sandy Hook. I mean, in Aurora and Sandy Hook were so close together that when we realized that people could kill kindergartners without any, you know, basically just treating them like animals, it was.
If you knew what I know about the wounds of those children and how they were killed, I can assure you that no one in America could stand silent.
Yeah.
But you don't do that to the families of the children. And you don't ask them to do that. I talk about Jesse's wounds. I always talk about Jesse's wounds. That's my choice because I do want people to be horrified by what happened just to one of those 12 people in that theater. Mm. You know, and it's hard. It takes something out of me every single time I do it. So to want or ask any of those parents to be able to do the same thing that I do, no, can't do it. No.
Oh, you're very brave for...
It's not bravery. It's wanting. It has nothing to do with bravery. It's painful to tell that story. It's excruciating every time, and it's 7 years down the road. Mm-hmm. But I want people to be horrified. I want them to be outraged. I want them to go, oh my God. And every time I tell that story, there's always somebody that either breaks down into tears or they're grabbing their mouth and like, oh my God, did you just, oh my God. You know, when I told the story, when I testified at the Senate Judiciary hearing, Senator Franken was still there. Mm-hmm. And when I told that story, he literally gasped and put his hand up to his mouth, like he couldn't believe what I was saying. But it was so important for me to be sure that they understood the truth and the realistic things that go on. It's not like TV. It's not like the movies. It's not like somebody gets shot and it's, you know, just one little wound and the next day they're up and back at work, you know. It's not like that. We saw people in Aurora that 5 years later had to have their leg amputated. We have two people that will always be in a wheelchair the rest of their lives. And unable to care for themselves. And that puts just the financial part of that is devastating, much less the emotional pain and the physical pain. So we have so much to do in this country when it comes to taking care of those who have been affected by gun violence. And you know, we're elderly. We're going to do everything we can to make sure that happens while we're still here.
What do you think? What do you think we're doing right as a country? Is there anything that you would say?
Not much.
Okay. I can't say I disagree with you.
No, not much. We really don't educate ourselves on this topic. We like the sound bites. We like the sound bites of guns don't kill people. People kill people. America, love it or leave it. All those little catchphrases those are sound bites. Hey, that sounds great. Yeah, I agree with that. You know, well, yeah, but when you look, when you research, when you dig deeper, when you say, wait a second, my neighbor's son just committed suicide by gun. How did he get that gun? Why was it unlocked? Why wasn't it stowed away? All those questions that we should be asking. And then we find out, oh, there's no law that says you have to do that. Oh, I can order 6,000 rounds of ammunition over the internet. We're not asking the right questions. And then we don't do anything about it. Once we do ask the right questions and get the answers, we're like, what? And, fortunately, our numbers are growing. And I say that fortunately they're growing because we have a lot of other people besides survivors that have gotten involved. And, boy, bless those people's hearts. You know, those are the ones that support us and we appreciate that because if it was left just to survivors, there wouldn't be enough people, although that number is growing every day, unfortunately, too. Yeah. But what happens with survivors is some of them get involved right away, like we did, and they burn out. Or some of them get involved for a while and say, you know, this isn't for me. I just can't do it anymore. Some do it and decide that, you know, I want to go a different direction on this. And what we have found is there's kind of a lane for everyone.
Okay.
So it's like, just keep going. And, in fact, I was talking to a woman who lost her child, in Santa Fe. At the Santa Fe school shooting, and she's got three bills that are that have been introduced in the Texas House, and she's very excited about it and very enthusiastic. And she says, "I know probably none of them will pass, but just the fact that we've got the bills is so good." And I said, "And what you've learned from that, and who you've learned will support you and who won't. That's an education in itself. So now she's becoming kind of a policy person. So that's her lane, and our lane is the survivor lane. And we've got other people who are taking on Google and Facebook. And so there's something for everyone in this movement. And we're now, just now, really, in the last 5 years, I'd say, becoming organized, where the NRA and the gun industry has been organized for 30 years, and we've been asleep at the wheel. Nobody really knew what they were doing. And now that more and more people are finding out what they were doing and what they continue to do, there's a lot of pushback on them these days, as well there should be. Here I grew up as an NRA member and a gun owner and all of that, but, you know, I know it's not my daddy's NRA. It's a very different organization, and not one that my father would have been proud to have been associated with.
Well, I think that's really important for people to know, though, and I think not enough people know that about you, that you guys were NRA members and you guys were... You know, I don't know if you were pro-gun. I don't know your stance prior, but I don't think enough people realize that you're not just some person who hates guns. And
And in fact, we work with a lot of gun owners who believe that we need to be doing a whole lot more than we're currently doing, mm-hmm. and don't agree with the NRA and have expressed it. So we're happy that that's happening more and more and more. We work with a lot of vets who feel the same way and say, you know, nobody needs to have an AR-15 or a weapon of war or a semi-automatic rifle. Nobody needs that. That's for war. People are beginning to speak out, and they are learning and they are educating themselves, because they're, so many are afraid that it's going to be at their doorstep next.
Well, that's,
we'll get there. It's just a matter of when, you know, but we will get there.
I believe that too. It's such an important subject, especially for our children. And it's such an important thing to take a side on. I think at this point in our lives, we have to take a side. You can't just stand on the sidelines anymore and watch.
I agree with you, Andrew. It's to the point where when you look at how the world sees us, mm-hmm. And we're laughed at, we're ridiculed. In fact, I got a message from a woman today who was over in Ireland, and the bus driver found out that somebody was from Texas on the bus, and said, "Oh, you know, Americans and their guns, you know, we don't have to worry about being safe here because people don't have guns here." Yeah. And I just went, yeah, there you go. But if I were to say that here, people, oh, see, she's trying to take our guns. No, nobody's trying to take your guns. Because the Second Amendment says well-regulated. And right now, nothing is well-regulated when it comes to guns. So we've got to get to the point where we're regulating guns in a way that we regulate cars. You have to have a license. You have to have inspections. You have to register. And why would that be any worse than owning a car?
Yeah.
How hard? I mean, it just doesn't make sense. It's not an infringement in any way. You can still own your gun. But we're going to make sure you know how to use it, know how to drive it. We're going to make sure that you do it safely, or you'll lose the privilege. We're going to be sure that it's registered, sure that it's licensed, and sure that you're okay and should be behind the wheel.
It's so simple. That's the thing I have a problem with, is it's so simple and not that, you know, not an infringement, like you said, and it's not, you know, we're not taking your guns, we're not doing it. It's so simple. It boggles
my
mind.
we've had organizations out there for many, many, many years pushing fear and wanting you to think that the government's going to be a tyrannical government and they're going to come and take your guns. So we bred in this fear and paranoia, and we've done it very well. So here it is, and this is why we can't seem to get anything done, because there are people that truly believe that. I had a person that I used to work with years and years ago who owns, evidently, several AR-15s, and he said that he had them because he's going to protect himself and his family if there's a tyrannical government. And I wrote back one word, drone.
Seriously.
You know, it's you know, come on. Rockets, drones, tanks, you know, what is an AR-15 going to do for you? Come on.
It's really crazy to think that that mentality is still, you know, in 2019.
Yeah.
Still exists. It's such a revolutionary war mentality, and it's far past that. I mean, the government has full control. I don't know if anybody's noticed.
Yeah, you think?
I don't know if anyone's noticed, you know, but I think we're already there, you know. So,
and right now we're really there. So,
oh, yeah, absolutely. One more thing I think I wanted to talk about that is important to me anyway. I don't think people realize how many trolls, you know, internet trolls and bullies and you know, how much hate you, not just you guys, but the survivors in general get. I don't think people realize what awful things are said, and the people who believe that all these things were false flags and just the ignorance of those people. How do you deal with that kind of stuff? And how do you...
You know, when it first started, I would try to engage and get them to think logically. And but it was taking its toll on me emotionally. And I did have a whole group of people that every time that kind of thing started, they would jump in and they'd take over, and, you know, they take care of them, so to speak. You know, I call them my knights in shining armor, you know, but now I just block them. There's no reason to engage with them. They are really, really either evil, awful people, or they're sick, or both. And I tend to lean towards the third. I think they're evil, awful people that are sick. And unfortunately, they own guns. So, you know, it's why we should be fearful. You know, I had one Republican senator said, well, I'm all in favor of doing something for mental health. And I said, great, then why did you vote against the last bill that was introduced on the Senate floor?
Did he have an answer for you?
No, he was surprised I knew. The look on his face was kind of like, oh, crap.
I love that. I love that. That's great.
And then it was, well, you know, there were parts in the bill that there's always parts in the bill that you're not going to like. So use that as your excuse. So, you know, he kind of did this whole song and dance about, well, you know, there were parts of the bill that just weren't right and I couldn't agree with, so I had to vote against it. How convenient. And so we've learned to push back, and we've learned to go in well armed, so to speak. Yeah. And you know, we had a meeting with Ted Cruz about 3 years after Jesse died, And it was a private meeting in San Antonio in a private room of a restaurant. And he started telling us all these facts and figures. And Lonnie, who's the quiet one of the two of us, my husband said to him, "Well, actually, sir, you're wrong about this, 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 and this," and then proceeded to tell him the correct dates and bill numbers, and the whole, just took him down. And at the end of it, you could tell he was furious with his staff for, having the meeting with us, and didn't bother to shake our hands when he left. So.
Wow.
It was pretty cool.
That's incredible, though. I just can't believe that. Wow. That a senator wouldn't shake your hand, at least. I mean,
No. Oh, that happens a lot. It's surprising how often the other side of this issue will not deal with you in a respectful way.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. It's, but that's the name of the game these days. You can't disagree with people.
Yeah. And it's a shame.
Yeah.
A good debate based on facts, is fine. And then you can get down to, okay, so you're just not in favor of this because you're taking big money from the NRA or a gun manufacturer or a pharmaceutical company or an oil company or whatever. But when you can't have a good debate on fact and merit, because they're taking money from these big industries, and are really just bought and sold, then you really know who you're dealing with. And quite frankly, that's not somebody that is ever going to move the needle on anything of importance to the American people.
So what do you think we can do as individuals? I know you talked a lot about educating ourselves, but what else do you think we can do?
You can get involved politically, and that means you start at the local level. Mm-hmm. And you say, hey, what kind of gun laws do we have in this city? What kind of gun laws do we have in this county? Do the sheriffs agree or disagree? Because quite often sheriffs will take the opposite side of good gun laws because they're elected and they live in rural communities. And rural communities are much more conservative, and they're much more frightened of anyone coming onto their property or trespassing, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the sheriffs will often be the ones that say, "Well, I'm not going to enforce that law." And it's like, wait a second, your law and order, your law enforcement, and this is the law. So, but yes, get involved on a local level first. Find out what your laws are. Find out where people stand as far as your electeds, and start that dialogue. And don't be afraid of the dialogue. I mean, if somebody is that vehemently disagreeing with you, then just say, "Okay, we're not going to get anywhere here," and you just let it go and walk away and hope to God that someday they're not faced with the same horror that we've been faced with. But have that dialogue, have it with your neighbors, but don't have it until you've educated yourself and you know the facts and you know the what's really going on in America on this issue. But have that talk, have it with your families, and know when to not have it.
That's the tough part.
it is, because again, these ideas have been in place for sometimes generations. I remember seeing my first time that I saw the guns don't kill people, people get kill people, was probably in the early 70s. And I looked at that and I read it again and I went, that is the stupid as, if I'm a gun owner, mind you, I'm looking at that and going, that is the stupidest bumper sticker I've ever seen. You know, people with guns kill people.
That is absolutely true.
Yeah.
It's so hard to talk about this stuff with anybody nowadays, though. It's so hard to bring it up. It brings out such an emotional reaction. And I think that's the sad part, is that it's always emotional. It's always an emotional reaction.
Yes, and if anyone has the right to be emotional, it would be those of us who have lost loved ones to gun violence.
Absolutely.
But it doesn't have to be emotional. It can just be, you know, look at what the rest of the world is doing about this issue. And look at the gun deaths. And then look at the chart that shows our gun deaths in comparison to any other country in the world. And that is, it's staggering. So why would you not want to do something that would protect your fellow man? Why would you not want to do simple things like having a background check on the sale of every single gun? Why would you not want to improve the NICS system to make sure that it's running accordingly, so that somebody who shouldn't be able to buy a gun isn't buying a gun? Why would you not want to dry up illegal guns on the street? Why would you not want to dry up trafficking of guns from one state into another? It doesn't make any sense.
It really doesn't. It's really, really a sad state that the country's in, and it's really unfortunate and sad to me that these types of things are so normal that we don't even notice them anymore, and we kind of just go, there's another one, and, you know.
And don't you think that that's exactly what the gun manufacturers and the NRA want?
Absolutely. It creates a lot of fear.
Absolutely.
Fear.
Absolutely. Keep the public unaware. Keep them numb to the violence around them. And then you can really control them, because they're living in fear and paranoia constantly.
I think a really interesting point is that these people are keeping these guns to protect themselves from a tyrannical government. But the fact that the government hasn't regulated those guns, and the government isn't worried where they are, and the government isn't concerned with how many you're buying or how easy it is to get them, kind of shows how unafraid they are that you have those guns.
Yes, exactly. And actually now, because the NRA is doing so poorly, they're actually trying to move the sale of guns on the international market from the State Department to the Commerce Department, so there won't be any restrictions. And that means that anybody who wants to buy a gun anywhere in the world, now I'm not talking a gun, I'm talking massive amounts of guns, can do so. So we're feeding right into terrorism groups. We're feeding right into gangs, the very thing that our president talks so much about. You know, oh, we got to be fearful of, you know, the gangs, and we have to be fearful of this group or that group. You know, by moving them, the sale of them, from the State Department with restrictions and regulations over to the Commerce Department without any, would allow that flood of guns to go into other countries. Can you imagine the havoc?
That's insane to me.
Yep. Yeah.
Wow. Well, on that note... yeah, I promise.
Doesn't that cheer you up?
That's terrifying. I promised I'd only keep you for an hour. Oh man, that's terrifying.
Yep.
Well, I hate to end it here, but I guess, do you have Any advice for listeners or a survivor that hasn't been able to or had the opportunity to contact you guys or
contact us, number one.
Okay.
We're here. We'll always be here for survivors of gun violence, number one. Number two, don't be afraid to speak out. Your voice matters. Every voice on this issue matters. And the more of us that are speaking out and saying this is wrong and this needs to stop and there are ways of fixing it and educating themselves, we'll get this. We will absolutely get this. It's just a matter of time. And hopefully we won't continue to lose 40,000 Americans every year before we do something about it. But I'm not giving up. I am hopeful. Even in the worst of times, even under the conditions in which we currently live, I see things happening in states that are California's got great gun laws. Washington State has passed great gun laws. New York just today passed a bunch of great gun laws. So it's happening, and it's happening more and more at the state level because we can't do anything right now under the current administration. We can't get anything done nationally. But even the case of this California shooting that just happened, this 19-year-old was able to go to Nevada and buy his gun because that gun is illegal in California. So if it was illegal to buy that gun across the country, that wouldn't have happened. And for those who would say, well, he'd find another way or he'd use another gun, you know, he was able to kill three and wound 12 in less than a minute with the gun that he had. And that means that's something that thank God there were police there and stopped him. But he was still able to destroy a lot of lives in less than a minute because of the gun that he was able to buy in a different state and transport into California. And that's why we need national law as well as state laws.
I think that's a perfect place to end it right there, actually, because I want people to remember that, and I want people to think about that.
Well, thank you for having me, Andrew. I appreciate it very much, and it's very nice to talk with you again.
Thank you, Sandy. I'm so honored that you were on, and I'm so proud of you and Lonnie. I know I really haven't spoken with Lonnie, but I'm, you know, really proud of you guys and proud of what you've done, and you've helped all of us tremendously. You probably don't even know how much, but you really have, and I just want to thank you for that. And I know I say that every time we talk, but it never stops being true.
Well, thank you very much. I want you to know that people like you and Jesse's friends and other survivors, we get our strength from you. So it's a symbiotic relationship. How's that?
That I like that. That's a great way to put it. Thank you. I like that a lot.
Okay.
And that concludes another episode of Far Betterment. Thank you to all my listeners. Thank you to all my subscribers. And thank you to everybody who's rated the podcast so far. If you haven't subscribed, you can find us on Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, Apple, anywhere that you listen to podcasts, including where you're listening to podcasts right now. And please, please don't forget to give us a 5-star rating. It helps us tremendously. I can't tell you how much it helps us. If you want to give us anything less than 5 stars, please don't. There's really no reason.